session number 30304.
Tadrina, reel 6.
The wind, you look for signs of the wind, obviously smoke, you've got to watch for the weather as well. You have an altimeter, of course, which is set on barometric pressure. So if you're caught out and you're having to fly in cloud, particularly with larger aircraft on actual operations, where you get a chance to reset the altimeter to a known height, and then you would take it, because that is an up-to-date setting which you've got to include in whatever you're doing, in working out whatever you're doing. Navigation was being learned all the time, both in the classroom and when flying. And the test, we had to land at Yatesbury, I remember, which actually was a small landing, quite a small land, very small landing field, but basically a WOPS, wireless operator, training center. I forget where the other one was. But it was a sort of three-legged cross-country, which on a nice day, of course, was very pleasant. You were on your own. It's a lovely area of the country, from Fair Oaks down to Yatesbury, which is somewhere on the Downs. I forget exactly where now. It was also a matter of timing. You were timed, you had to record your time, it was recorded for you, and passed on. At each of the stops, you had to decide, I mean, you may have been blown off course and used up a lot of petrol, you had to decide whether you had sufficient petrol for the distance you still had to cover, and so on. Usually they were about the total length of time on a cross-country in elementary training was about 3 hours in total.
Would you use a map?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Obviously, these things are they're so second nature that you forget about them. You're following a map. You have to... I'm sorry, this should have come right at the beginning, because obviously you have to go, you're told where you've got to fly A, B, and C. You will get the necessary information, including the wind speed on the ground, the height at which you should be best to fly, much more important nowadays than it used to be. I mean, in the sense of airmanship and obeying rules. And you would plot the track which you intended to take. There may be some need, you may be instructed to not go directly from A to B, but from go, say, you've got to find that land, that landmark there, and then you've got to find that one. And so on. That would have to be passed by your flying instructor, that you knew what you were doing. You would need to use the course and speed calculator, which was a sort of slide rule which automatically gave you the course to steer when you applied the wind force to it. Really it was a triangle of velocities. I can't remember any occasion when it wasn't, when it was a straight line. You have a wind vector, obviously that's most important, not least when you come into land at the strange airfield, where you need to be very vigilant about the way their windsock is blowing, so that you can land into wind. Notice their signal square in front of every watchtower, I suppose would be the best name for them, because that's where the officer of the day would be, or someone supervising the flying. There, in front of that, there would be the landing instruction square with a large T appropriate to the position the aircraft should be in order to come into land, and other things, identification, etc. So I found the navigation one of the things I did better than most, I think.
One of the things that interests me is, how easy was it to read a map in an open cockpit aircraft?
Well, we had those, I think they were called Sidley overalls. They were lined in sheep's wool of some kind with the goggles, and it was quite a load to carry on your person together with your, when you came out from the parachute store. What was the question?
How easy was it to...
Oh, yes, the maps, yes. They had various, as they do nowadays, of course, have pockets on them. And you could fold the maps into and put them in a pocket on the top of your trouser leg, or wherever. I mean, do as you like, but it was there if you wanted to use it. And most maps fold to a convenient size. Certainly, the ones that we had were meant to fit in these, and they were just there. You fold it so that you would do the first leg, and then if you needed to change, you would go on to the next page or whatever it was whilst your aircraft was being checked or refueled or you were booking or whatever.
And am I right in this, when you were saying doing a cross-country exercise, you're always engaged in something, either reading the map or looking at the ground or checking the instruments. There's always, it's a continuous...
Oh, absolutely,
process.
Yes. Well, I don't know how much that applies nowadays to these almost automated, horrible machines, that's what flying was about. I mean, you're not up there just simply to have a snooze, or unless there was some very good reason for it and you had a co-pilot or whatever. No, you've got to be on the qui vive. Not only that, I mean, it was very interesting. It was just the thing that most lads I knew wanted to do. And a wonderful opportunity.
One of the things you mentioned is, and again it might be slightly obvious, is landing into wind. Why do you need to land into wind?
All landing grounds are restricted in size. You can't go on forever and ever. The places where you can do that, of course, are in certain deserts and such like places, but aerodromes have a limited area. The best way to answer that is to think of a runway 100 yards long, and if normally you come into land at 50 miles an hour, I don't know how long that would take you to come to the end of the runway. What's 100 yards, the 17th part of a mile, 5 miles. the point I'm trying to make is that if you're flying into wind, whether it's over a runway or coming in to land, that wind is reducing your ground speed. That's another thing I should have mentioned, in that, of course, there's a lot of difference, or can be a lot of difference, between airspeed and ground speed. And the wind is responsible for that difference. So if you don't land into wind, let's imagine you are landing on this runway of 100 yards long. Normally, before you can stop, you have used 75 yards of it, and that is when there's no wind at all. Then if there's a wind blowing down the runway of 20 miles an hour or so, then you would stop, because the wind is against you all the time the aircraft is rolling along the runway. And of course, in an aircraft with brakes, you would be applying brake as necessary. But let's forget about the brakes, because that's not illustrative of this particular query. But if you were to land in the opposite direction, with the wind behind you as you came into land, you would find that you would soon run out of runway, because it's not helping to stop you. Sorry, I'm not doing any damage to this. I just got a little itch there. that's it.
While you were under training here, were you given any instruction on how to carry out a forced landing?
Oh, yes. That would be part of the precautionary flying section. I have mentioned, I think, precautionary landings. So far as emergency landings are concerned, there are different kinds, of course, two main kinds. First of all, if you have engine trouble in a single-engine aircraft, then you've got to obviously get down to the ground when you can and as soon as you can. If it's not a matter of great emergency, if, for instance, you think the engine is giving, or you're losing a lot of oil, you can tell that, you know, oil is splattering around, then it's obvious that you would need to land fairly soon. And if you're in an area where you can't identify a suitable landing area, and not including an airfield nearby, if you're in bad luck, in other words, then you would carry out a precautionary landing. And also in bad weather, you would make a precautionary approach. That is, coming in at a slightly different, a slightly longer, lower attitude, but with power, more than you would if you were just coming in a tiger moth anyway, to glide, more or less glide down onto the runway. So if the engine suddenly stops, you look for a suitable place, a golf course, any flat area, preferably not an arable field if it's near harvest time, not just because you may be an irate farmer after you, but because the aircraft would tend to tip onto its nose. I'm speaking of a tiger moth now in particular, as the wheels would come into contact with the growth, and the top of the aircraft wouldn't, and then you'd have a tipping effect, and that can be quite serious if you tip up so that the aircraft is nose on the ground and the tail up in the air, not least to get out of it. if you're making a precautionary approach, you may feel confident enough to have a look around at a low, very low level, always ready to take advantage of something that may appear over the hedge, a level space or something like that. And of course you would do as much of this before you came down to that level as you could, having a look around. But a precautionary approach would be at a low level, almost as low as you could get, bearing in mind the need to have a bit of a landscape view. And be ready. You've got to be more or less in the attitude so that if you suddenly come across some area that you could land on, be ready to close the engine down and get the three wheels on the ground.
What obstacles would you be specifically looking out for?
Well, you're looking for, if you're, it depends so much on the topography, that if you're in an area heavily forested, obviously you would put that behind you sort of thing. Well, I've been there and I'm not going to try that sort of thing. But if there's only the occasional tree, you've got to try and think of a track you could take. A track in the air, not that you could take to avoid that. Of course, if you're over the sea, and then the important thing is to try and keep the aircraft in a good settling position so that it will at least remain on the surface long enough for you to get out of the cockpit. I don't know if that...
Was there anything that you'd also have to look for? I was thinking like maybe overhead power lines.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Things that you'd have to be aware of.
Yes.
Sort of
wires. Of course, don't forget I'm talking of a long time ago. And there weren't the obstacles that there are today. I wouldn't fancy my chances very much of a sudden need to land unless I was somewhere over the well-known open areas such as the Downs and that kind of area. But yes, I mean, you're quite right. Obviously, buildings, you avoid buildings. There are, even today, light aircraft which are crashing because they haven't seen these obstacles. You've got to do a lot in a very short time.
Am I right in thinking as well, during this period of instruction and the solo flights that you were taking, that you were getting used to always being aware of the environment that you were flying in case there was a need for precautionary landing?
Yes. I think that's truer, of course, when you are under training or when you're what we call SPROG pilots with very little experience, you're always looking, well, would I be able to put down there? I mean, when you're going away from the airfield to do something that you've been told is the next thing on the list, I'm sure a lot of others, would practice one or two of these things that I thought might be necessary, and if I found a suitable area, there weren't many around Fair Oaks, really, because it soon becomes built up in around the Woking area and so on. The other places, on the Downs and so on, certainly on the cross country itself. If you saw a field that might be a possibility for a forced landing, it was quite commonplace to, when I say commonplace, I mean that there'd be several, I'm sure there are several of us who would do it, say, well, I'll just have a go and see if I can get in that field, not to land it, but to know that I'm there. and I could land it if I wanted to, and then just zoom away and carry on with the journey. I mean, obviously, any sensible person takes every opportunity when you're learning these things.
And I'm wondering, were you given instruction on what to do, say you had a problem when you were taking off, say with a problem with the engine? Was there a specific technique of what you'd have to do at that point?
Well, the only thing that that you can do is to try to keep flying speed. That depends on what obstructions there are, whether the area that you're obviously going to come down in is fairly close to where the engine fails. Depends on the height that you are. I mean, if you get to 100 feet, then you've got a much better chance of putting it down. The main thing about engine loss, power loss, shortly after takeoff is it worth making a turn? Because a turn is going to affect the range that you can cover, the distance that you can cover, because as I think I explained earlier, that you're depriving the aircraft of some of its lift when you go into a turn, unless you remedy it in other ways, and you certainly can't remedy it by use of power if you haven't got any power. So it's best, unless it's vital, I mean, to miss a building or to find an area where there would be a possibility of survival, keep your airspeed if you can, and put the aircraft down as much as you can, like a landing.
Were you given any instruction at all on the use of the parachute during this training? Because you said you were wearing one, but obviously, were you given any instruction at all?
No, other than where to pull. We went into, and I'm not sure whether this was where this happened in training, we went into a parachute packing place to see how they were packed, what they were like. And there were two types, of course. There were the sit-upons, and the ones that you clipped onto your chest for chaps who had to move about on the aircraft. But not for tiger moths, of course, just the sit-upons. All we knew was that you pulled this or that and so on. And that if you can, you fall so that your legs take as much of actual grounding as you can. In other words, bending your legs as you go and roll forward and hold on to your canopy and reel it in as quickly as you can. Otherwise, you're going to be dragged along the ground. But that's about all. And really, it's all that was necessary. I mean, as long as you... I don't suppose they could, at that stage, have said, well, because there are various ways of getting out of aircraft, until you were actually part of an air crew, you wouldn't know which particular way out was going to be yours. I mean, with the Hudson, you could open the top or the side window. Henry, a pal of mine who was shot down and came to with the aircraft beginning to sink, found that he got through the side window, and it seemed incredible. Whereas the crew, the door would come off, or you can make it come off at the back. They would go out that way, so according to where they would be. So they had the certain type of parachute. But that was as far as it got with a parachute. Fortunately for me, another pal, when we were down at St. Edel, he had to parachute out because the airfield was covered in fog. We couldn't land. And he broke his ankle in landing. He landed on the beach. He was rather heavier than I was, though. It's just bad luck, you know.
Could I ask something about the Tiger Moths that you were training on? What did they actually look like? I'm thinking of the colour and did they have camouflage or were they...
Well, yes. The training machines used before the war, Tiger Moths, they were a sort of orange colour. And I think they were black underneath. But during the war, and that continued for some time, they varied after that. Some I saw up and down the country had the usual camouflage, orange and brown, and we always with, as I remember seeing them, always with an orange-coloured top wing. I may be wrong there, I don't remember. I've got a picture of them, if that's any help for you personally. I don't suppose it's any use for that.
The ones that you were doing, though, were they not camouflaged, the ones that you were flying?
I can't honestly say. I think when we started they weren't. Because I seem to remember describing them as orange butterflies sort of fluttering around the first time we saw them. They were orange, but then they did, I'm quite sure before we left Fair Oaks in 1940, they had, some of them anyway, had camouflage.
And given the time of year that you were training, was there a lot of problems with the weather?
Well, it did extend the course considerably, and that was why there was a bottleneck at some of the pilot reception places. Normally, the course would have lasted 3 months, and we went there in November of 1930, well, the end of November, let's say December. So normally, December, January, February, had the weather been good, we should have been going to operational training units at the end of February. In fact, we didn't get there until April, early April 1940. The place had to close down, and of course lots of airfields throughout the country, here and on the continent, had to. It was a bad winter.
What would you do on days that you couldn't fly? What would be the...
Well, there would be extra drill or a chance to make up on classroom work or even leave. Well, we had an extra week's leave around Christmas, I remember, because of the early January. That was after Christmas. 1940, because the airfield would just close down completely.